the United States side was designed for short war, preferably against a weak opponent that lacked air and missile defense, not much naval power or air power to speak of. And so you take this force structure, which on the surface looked fine, and you commit it against an enemy that you grossly underestimated, and you're waging a purely offensive operation. You suddenly discover the place is enormous. You know, it's got mountains for fortress borders, and all of its critical equipment and capabilities are either underground or in space. So, you know, what do you do at that point? Well, we had the wrong force for the wrong mission in the wrong place at the wrong time. Does that mean that we're weak and incapable? No, I don't think it does at all. But the big problem we've had over the last, certainly since 1991, is nobody's really looked at the force structure and looked at the requirements for any kind of major war.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Peacemonger. I'm Ian Proud. Today, I'm joined by retired US Army Colonel Douglas McGregor and former Royal Navy Commodore Steve Jeremy for a hard look at the state of Western military power. We examine why NATO, despite accounting for more than half of global defense spending, has suffered two major geostrategic defeats in just 4 years. Doug explains how US force structures have been designed for short wars against weak opponents and were completely unsuited to the realities of the Persian Gulf, leaving us with the wrong force for the wrong mission in the wrong place at the wrong time. We also discuss the urgent need to redefine our real strategic interests, the dangers of financialization and ideology, and why going broke may finally force a fundamental rethink our defense establishments have avoided for decades. If you find conversations like this valuable, please click the subscribe button and the notification bell so you never miss an episode. And wherever you are in the world, whatever your nationality and your religion, I wish you much peace. Now for today's video.
Because I went there with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff when we were supporting, and I was there at the Navy-Army match. Goodness.
Oh, really? Yeah. Was it a cold one?
Yeah, it really was. Well, we had to cross the pitch halfway, so we spent the first half on the Army side and the second half on the Navy side.
Yeah. Where were you treated better?
Oh, good question. I think we were pretty well treated on both sides.
Yeah. Well, we decided everybody on the Navy side was doing better than we were. We always said, we're cold. We have nothing to drink. We're treated badly. And everybody on the other side has got warm drinks. They're very warm and everything else. So I don't know.
Yeah. It's a Navy thing.
Well, on military matters, I have a big question for you both, really. It's not that big a question, actually. But a couple of years ago, when I looked at the numbers, NATO accounted for 53% of global military spending. And I think that number must have gone up since that time, as European countries have slowly started to increase their defense spending. Yet this is the only time, well, at least I can recall, I'm still quite a young chap, the Western Alliance has faced two geostrategic defeats in the space of 4 years. And that kind of feels unprecedented to me. What's your sense of where that leaves us in terms of our role in the world? Maybe so, Doug.
Well, that's a good question. You know, I tend to think of NATO or NATO forces. And when we say NATO forces, we're always talking about a very limited number of them, because only a limited number really cooperate with us on a routine basis. And, I was in a different setting this morning, and I was asked what the real problem was with regard to our military power and its alleged failure in the Persian Gulf. And I said, well, the truth is, and this has been true now, I would say, for certainly 30-plus years, the entire force structure on the United States side was designed for short war, preferably against a weak opponent that lacked air and missile defense, not much naval power or air power to speak of. And so you take this force structure, which on the surface looked fine, and you commit it against an enemy that you grossly underestimated, and you're waging a purely offensive operation. You suddenly discover the place is enormous. You know, it's got mountains for fortress borders, and all of its critical equipment and capabilities are either underground or in space. So, you know, what do you do at that point? Well, we had the wrong force for the wrong mission in the wrong place at the wrong time. Does that mean that we're weak and incapable? No, I don't think it does at all. But the big problem we've had over the last, well, certainly since 1991, is nobody's really looked at the force structure and looked at the requirements for any kind of major war. We just looked at the sort of piles, mountains of dumb bullets and dumb bombs and said, well, look at this. You've got all these. And how many of these precision guided munitions are we really going to need? Nobody paid attention after the Kosovo air campaign, where we expended vast quantities of PGMs. We simply declared victory and patted ourselves on the back when in reality, we didn't win anything. Stroke Talbot flew to Moscow, negotiated a deal with the Russians. We basically bribed them for billions of dollars and they dropped Milosevic. And the Serbs, 8 million of them, finally discovered, you know, we're not going to have any heat for the winter because the Russians are going to provide any coal or oil or anything else. And so they said, we'll leave Kosovo. The air campaign was not victorious. Did a lot of damage, cost a lot of money. At the time, I think it cost an estimated $4 billion, which was not much when you think that we did almost $9 billion worth of damage. That's twice. So I guess that was a good investment if all you want to do is damage. But no one's really looked at anything because we haven't looked at anything. We haven't questioned anything. What's happened in Europe? Nothing. You know, I had this conversation with the German four-star who is the chief of staff at Supreme Headquarters of Allied Powers Europe. Very intelligent man. Very much a Prussian, born in Prussia, born in Posen before it became Polish again. And we talked exactly about these things. You know, what kind of force are we building? He'd read my book, Breaking the Phalanx, liked it. And I said, what are we building for? You know, and he said, that's the question nobody wants to answer. And when you start to ask that question, then you begin to question everything that you do and everything you've got. The politicians aren't interested in that. They just want to see money spent. And they equate money spent with defense achieved. So to answer your question is very difficult, but I think we're all in the same kind of boat. There may be, you know, if you look at the British Army, somebody said it's too small. I said, well, I agree it's too small. But what kind of army do you want? What do you want it to do? How's it going to fight? If it fights, where is it going to fight? I mean, we're back to Richard Haldane in 1905, asking the same kinds of questions. Now, he did a pretty fine job, in my estimate, getting that army ready to fight. What he couldn't do, he could not implement a draft because nobody was interested in paying a million men to stand around waiting for a war. So instead, he made, you know, virtue of necessity, built a very good professional army. The problem was, however good it's going to be crushed by the Imperial German Army, which had built for a very different kind of war for the British Expeditionary Force. So, you know, we're all in that again. And I haven't talked to anybody that has a really satisfactory answer. I mean, the same problem in the Navy. I worked for the Austin Secretary of Navy from about 2008 until 2011. Then they found out we were affiliated with Republicans and Obama had taken over, so they threw us out. But we did a lot of good work for the Secretary of the Navy's office, and that, this kind of thing came up again and again. And they had a very good Secretary of the Navy. And at the time, this is 2007, 2008, he said, well, instead of sitting down and trying to draw up designs for new ships, because that hadn't worked very well, and the designs were outrageous. You know, you've seen the Zumwalt, you know, multi-billion dollar destroyer. Yeah. Oh, my God. How many surface ships could you have built for that? And he knew that. And he said, well, why don't we lease one of these Swedish corvettes or something? You know, see how that performs. And, of course, it had water jet propulsion. And the Navy was horrified by water jet propulsion. The Navy wanted everything to have a screw that turned. You know, we all agree that we'd like screws that turn, but, you know, is that necessarily the future? But anyway, he failed. He wasn't able to do it. I think we've got to reach some sort of, epiphany about the whole thing. Now, I think what's happening in the Persian Gulf is helping. It's not going to happen right away, but it's helping. And then we need to decide what we really want, what we really need. It's going to be painful. One, we do have a source of support, though. It's called going broke. We're not going to have any money. And that's not all bad. You know, it's sort of ending up like the Reichswehr after World War One. They had no money. They didn't have anything. Yet that was a very important period in the history of the German military establishment. Mm. The Russians or the Bolsheviks were not very different. They ran into similar problems, which is why they reduced their army in 1924, or I guess it was 24, just before Lenin cracked up and died, from 5 million down to 600,000, which is rather dramatic for one of the largest countries in the world, if it wasn't the largest.
Yeah.
But you got to go through this. Nobody wants this.
Yeah.
But we need it.
Yeah. Steve.
Yeah, I completely agree, Doug. I've been sort of thinking about this a lot. I did an article for, I think it was Brave New Europe about a year ago, and I was talking about the fundamentals of military power. And it seemed to me, on a slightly different page here to John Mearsheimer, that the two critical things I used to say were industrial capacity and energy. And you needed both to actually run a war. And the famous quote I used was from Yamamoto, who was the admiral who, oversaw the early days of the war. And he said, anybody who's been to the oil fields of Texas or the automobile factories of Ohio knows that we can never win a long-term war with the United States. And he was right, of course. But I think we've lost sight of that. The thing I add now to there's a third element, which we're also lacking in, which is the ability to think strategically and clearly. And we've just lost that completely. But I think the two other things that I've come to realize are also playing into this. The first is that I think, certainly for the United States, but also to a lesser extent for Britain, we have sort of armies which are, we have armed forces which are configured more for air, sea, rather than land. And of course, the primary opponents at the moment that we've mistakenly chosen are configured the other way around, but they're also configured in a way where they can deny us air superiority and they can deny us sea control. And that's a very, very fundamental change. There's another thing that I think is also very interesting, which is to pick up on your point, Doug, that people say, no, we need to spend more money. And I keep saying, well, surely we should work out why we want to spend the money. And the second thing is we should work out if the money's being well spent. Now, if you listen to Professor Michael Hudson, he'll distinguish between, on the one hand, industrial capitalism, which he says is what happens in Russia and China. On the other hand, sort of services capitalism, financial capitalism, I'm sorry, is the word he used, which is what happens in the West. You know, so we've got most of our GDP is made up of services, which is fine unless you want to fight a war. And so I think we get particularly poor value for money in the West and the way we spend money on defense. I'm not 100% sure why, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. Because I look at the force structure that we've got at the moment. I just take my own service, the Royal Navy. Yeah, we're spending probably a little bit less than we were, but we've got 12 hulls, I suppose, at frigates and destroyers versus 70 when I was serving. You know, and that matters because, the numbers do actually matter if you want to use forces at sea. There are a whole range of reasons for that, but they matter. So I think that the idea that we can just spend more money and that will solve the problem, let me forget it. Forget it. Think about really how we spend the money and what we're going to spend the money for and also where we invest. And I'm just about to stop, but, of course, one of the issues is NATO. And I'm just doing an article which is about how we should be retiring NATO because we don't get good value for money. The best we make in NATO, and it doesn't work.
Well, you know, one of my favorite people is former Prime Minister Campbell Bannerman. Campbell Bannerman gets very little attention because he offended the British public when he apologized for what the British Army and its forces had done to the Boer population. You'll recall the concentration camp, 78,000 or so dead as a result, women and children and else. I always thought he was a very great man. But he also had a very good head on his shoulders. And when he was meeting with the French, and of course, you remember Henry Wilson, I guess was his name, was pushing this Franco-German business in World War One.
Yeah.
Bannerman didn't have much use for him. And he was in a discussion with the president of France. And the president of France said, well, this is very important to us because when we go to war, we want the British Army with us. And he said, what? He said, on the continent? He said, yes. And he said, well, that's outrageous. He said, why would we ever put a British army on the continent? That would be a serious strategic mistake. It would ruin us. And that's not our interest. Our interests are elsewhere, not on the continent. And, of course, he was right. Mm. Unfortunately, he dies. And he's succeeded by that jackass Asquith, who knew absolutely nothing about much of anything, as far as I can tell, with the foreign minister, Grey, who was equally ignorant. The next time you get somebody who has got his head on, in my judgment, is Macmillan.
Mm.
And Kennedy is talking to Macmillan and mentions Vietnam in the future. Macmillan says, forget it. It's not going to happen. Made that very clear to LBJ. Unfortunately, you know, Macmillan doesn't last. He goes away. Made a lot of sense. And the problem that we have right now is that whatever we're doing is completely divorced from tangible, concrete, strategic interest.
Mm.
We are in the hands or the grip of a small minority of very wealthy people. We call it AIPAC, Zionists. It's this Jewish financial elite that's played a major role in financializing the economy because that's how they make money. These are not production capitalists. This is not J.D. Rockefeller, Vanderbilt, Carnegie, you know, building steel mills, you know, turning out railroads and so forth. These are financial experts who've turned everything into a casino, and then they control the betting. And you've seen that with the manipulation of the cost of oil by the White House. You know, every time Trump makes a statement, suddenly all sorts of people short oil or make investments, and then you find out, well, gee, I guess they had the word for the White House. You think? So we've got a real problem with corruption and financialization. That's not going to go away. And the impossibility of really establishing what's in our interest. And, you know, why would the British want an army of 250,000? There's no reason for that.
Mm.
I don't know what the number is, but you know, where do you plan to fight? What are you planning to do? And that question needs to be answered honestly. If we had been honest with ourselves, we'd say, wait a minute, you want us to put an expeditionary force to run into Yemen and capture the Houthis? Well, we can look at that. You know, we have the naval power. We have over 100,000 Marines looking for something to do. So potentially we could do that. But if you want us to go to the Persian Gulf and challenge Iran, have you looked at the geography? That's absurd. Mm. It makes no sense. Mm. Crazy. But that wasn't done. Nobody brought it up.
Yeah.
And that's why the other problem, and I'm sure you could talk about this, where have we gotten these people?
Mm.
I remember Montgomery during the Second World War, 1942, grew sick of the Canadians who wanted to land desperately in Normandy. They were as bad as we were. We wanted to go to Normandy in 1942. Of course, everybody with any sense knew anything about the German military said, that's absurd, you'll get killed. But finally, you had Mountbatten, who had created this sort of flotilla of ships, and he was going to support the intervention at Dieppe.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, Montgomery finally said, do it. Go ahead. And he reasoned later on it was better to go ahead and do that, lose people that way, then bet everything on a large invasion, which was premature and unprepared. And he was right. Mm. Sad. But we have a lot of Dieppe thinkers,
if
I call them thinkers at all. We don't have anybody who's asking the hard questions and answering them, and nobody will stand up to anybody. And now to listen, as I have to these Democrats on the Hill, these senators.
Well, you know, Mr. Hegseth, you, this is your failure. You failed. That's why we're failing in the Gulf. Our soldiers can do anything.
You know, the last man that said our soldiers can do anything was Adolf Hitler. Okay. Mm. He had a much better case, and he was wrong. And everybody knew he was wrong. We can't do everything, nor should we try, nor should we need to. But no one will stand up and do it. So you have all these four stars. Well, Mr. President, this could be tough, but I'm with you. And, you know, when Hegseth shows up as Secretary of Defense, nobody walks up and says, well, Mr. Hegseth, you really need to look through this briefing that we've prepared and all these materials, because you will find what the true stocks are for all the critical munitions, missiles. You will look at all the constraints as well as the advantages, our force structure has, and some of the requirements we may want to look into for the future if we are going to conduct active military operations. Nobody does that. And he shows up, and they give him a funny little hat, Jeremy. Do you do that? Royal Navy, you give the new minister a funny little hat, and it's the boss with little stars on it. And he stands there, oh, this is great. I'm in charge of the Navy now. They sort of stick a lollipop in his mouth, you know, give him a sedative, send him to bed. You know, it's ridiculous. Don't get me started. Yeah. So I think it's a mess.
I think you're onto the other thing. This, I mean, when I said that one of the problems we have is the inability to think strategically, the people who do the strategic thinking are the establishment, the right people right up at the top of the establishment. They're the generals, the admirals, the air marshals, the senior civil servants. It's not just the politicians. And I feel a little bit for the politicians because they ultimately come in often from a business background or something else, and they sort of rely on the possibility or the hope that actually the people who talk to them know what they're talking about. But as I say, the thing is, when you're thinking about strategy, you know you've been successful if the results of your strategy were effective, they were efficient, and they're enduring. And if you can pass those three tests, then you've got a solid way of measuring strategy. And it's a pretty hard-nosed way of measuring strategy. But on those measures, we've lost everything we've done this century. Everything. There's not a single thing that I think that we've done. And I don't think that's just the fault of the politician. I mean, Ian, you as a diplomat will know as well, because it's not just about the military, but it's about the diplomats as well. And somewhere the advice that's being provided to people is not right. I mean, it's obvious in the results, but nothing seems to be being done about it.
It's paradoxical. I think there's a culture of saying what the elected people want to hear. For the actual machine to kind of not deviate from long-standing, you know, norms and assumptions, you know, about how the world is, as you're churning out the same old kind of slop lines whenever a new, and in the case of the UK, new prime ministers, new foreign secretaries, new defence ministers come along on a very, very regular basis. So when they do, we give them the lines, you know, we tell them, yes, we should defeat Russia. Russia's bad and nothing really kind of changes. And it's that kind of political culture that actually our admirals, our generals and so on, air marshals are all yes men, really, sitting on top of a really corrupt pile of, defense procurement that can't actually provide them in any case with the capabilities that they need during an era in which our young people don't want to fight anyway. That's how I would sum it up.
I can tell you a story from the MOD. I was the what's known as the principal staff officer, but it's the executive assistant to our chief of defence staff, who's the equivalent to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And we came in as we were going into Helmand, moving from Iraq and essentially redeploying because we got our asses kicked in Basra. The team came up with what they thought was the right force laydown. And I said to them, is this what you need? And they said, no. I said, well, why haven't you asked for what you need? He said, well, we didn't think the politician would wear it. I said, that's not your job. Your job is to actually work out what it is you think you need. Then if the politicians don't wear it, that's a political choice. Your job is to explain what's needed. I think there's not enough of that. As it turned out, we put the wrong force structure, and I now know, having been in Afghanistan, because we weren't thinking about the campaign in the right way. But nevertheless, I think it's for military people and security people and diplomats to actually present what they think is the right thing to do to the politicians. And if politicians choose not to do it for political reasons, then at least they'll have had the right advice.
Yeah, no, exactly. Sorry, Steve, were you going to say something?
Have we had any political leaders that you can think of in the West in the last, let's say, 25, 30 years who really did think strategically at all?
Very good question. I think a good intuitive thinker was probably Margaret Thatcher. She, I'm not sure, I mean, she didn't anticipate the Falklands War, but she did seem to understand the relationship with Gorbachev and how important that was, and as indeed did Ronald Reagan. And because the three of them got on, you know, I think that really mattered. But again, I'm thinking of the other ones. I mean, the one who had the chance to make a difference was Tony Blair, but he blew that in the Iraq War. People often say, and you may have heard this as well, Doug, that the two people who could have stopped the Iraq War were Colin Powell and Tony Blair. I think that's right. But instead, Tony Blair did the opposite. And his team fudged the intelligence for political reasons, I think, as a consequence. You know, we lost all of those people and spent all that time there being, largely speaking, ineffective. We also, as a result of that, took our eyes off Afghanistan, which was a major mistake. But no, I'd struggle to think of the political thinkers. I suppose John Major wasn't bad. Again, over to you, Ian, in terms of our leaders.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say, well, none in this century, really. I think that there's a case that can be made that Angela Merkel, you know, was a pragmatic kind of strategic thinker. Mm. There's definitely a case to be made that Putin outthinks us on a pretty much on a daily kind of a basis. But there's also a question actually about whether, you know, we in the Anglo-Saxon West, we just have an essentially kind of short-term horizon, A, because of our electoral cycles, and B, because of our kind of culture of individualism where everything has to be short-term right now, whereas the Russians, the Chinese in particular, think about everything in the long term. It's like the kind of Zhao Enlai quote, you know, what's your view on the French Revolution? He said, it's too early to tell. It's just like, we always want results, you know, right now, and we can never deliver them. Yeah. But our admirals, our generals, our air marshals have to say something. So they say, well, yes, we can. You know, yes, we should invade Iraq. Yes, we should go into Afghanistan. And of course, the Taliban would say, well, you guys have got the watches, but we've got the time. And sure enough, after a period of time, we left. We don't have the time in Ukraine. We don't have the time in Iran. Time is always on their side, right? And space.
Well, I don't think we have the interest.
Mm.
Why would we want to expend enormous amounts of money and resources in a place like Afghanistan?
Mm.
Or for that matter, Iraq? I mean, one of the most intelligent things I heard when I first arrived there in 1990, we picked up our gear, interestingly enough, in Al-Shabaab, and then headed out to the desert, west, and then a little north, way out beyond the border of Kuwait, where Saudi Arabia and so forth, the so-called neutral zone, and which was a great place for us to be and train and prepare. But one of the soldiers got out of his truck near the tactical operation, and he looked around. He said, my God, there's nothing in this place. What are we doing here? Well, you know, the average soldier, if you give him a chance, is not stupid.
Mm.
I've been listening to soldiers come back and tell me, you know, there's nothing in this place. What are we doing here? You're not dealing with modern societies that are sitting on top of any kind of scientific industrial base with the kind of human capital that you need for a modern state. Now, that doesn't mean they can't get there. It's going to take time. But it does beg the question, what are we doing?
Hmm.
We're here to help them. Well, if you're here to help them, we're poised to kill large numbers of them. Killing them, help them. You know? This is my problem with Africa Command. What are we doing in Africa? Marching large numbers of troops to the neighborhood? Well, that's the last thing the Africans need, in my judgment. So, you know, we had this, we're at cross purposes. There's a great book, and I periodically push it to people, and I'm going to push it here. And it's about the United States. It's a very good book.
Ooh.
It's called Crusader State.
Hmm.
And Promised Land, Crusader State, The American Encounter with the World Since 1776. Written by a great man whose name was Walter McDougall. That's no accident. He's a clear-thinking Scotsman. We do have a few of those. But at any rate, Walter McDougall goes through this thing in great detail, and he deals with all these things. And he goes through asking the questions about what the hell are we thinking and why? Because we've always had this messianic streak.
Mm.
We managed to suppress it, keep it under control, until the 20th century. And then it found a fellow traveler, the internationalists, financial capitalists, that saw money and opportunity in all of this to drag us in the direction of conflicts they wanted to fight.
Mm.
And the two merged in uncomfortable ways. And we're now bankrupt as a result.
Yeah.
We have to be honest about that. We are.
I've got a lovely, can I just read a quote to you both? This is from George Keenan, who I'm a great fan of. Oh. He's talking in 16th February 1996 to the Foreign Relations Committee of the Senate. He said, and it's about Vietnam. He says, if we were not already involved as we are today in Vietnam, I would know of no reason why we should wish to become so involved. And I can think of several reasons why we should wish not to. Vietnam is not a region of major military industrial importance. It's difficult to believe that any decisive developments of the world situation will be determined in normal circumstances by what happens in that territory. If it were not for the considerations of prestige that arise precisely out of our present involvement, even a situation in South Vietnam was controlled exclusively by the Viet Cong, whilst regrettable and no doubt morally unwarranted, would not, in my opinion, present dangers enough to justify a direct military involvement. That's just perfect thinking as far as I can see, because he's just sort of encapsulated. And yet we keep doing this.
Well, remember, he ended up being buried for many years because when he was visited in Moscow by Harry Hopkins, who was the right-hand man, and we were pretty convinced an NKVD agent, right-hand man for FDR. And he was there to meet personally with Stalin. And Hopkins did meet with Stalin. There was no one else present. The ambassador who was there and the defense attaché were both prohibited from attending the meeting. He came in as a matter of courtesy to speak to Kennan. And Kennan said, I can think of no area in which our interests and the interests of Stalin and the Soviet Union and the Communist Party of the Soviet Union intersect. So he said, I urge you to provide them with nothing. He was right. This is July of 1941. This is a week and a half after invasion of the Soviet Union had begun. He meets with Stalin some 2 to 3 weeks into it. And what we found out later was that he handed this sheet of paper, just like a legal pad, on the table with Stalin and said, President Roosevelt has asked me to tell you we will give you whatever you want. Just write down what it is that you need, and we will ship it.
Interesting.
Zhukov, as has been recently revealed, admitted in a discussion that he had that without us, they could not have withstood the Germans.
He's
absolutely right. So I think Kennan was always adept at discovering where we had an interest and where we didn't. He was then accused of being a Nazi. He was not a Nazi. He wasn't interested in success of the Nazis, but he did not see the value in making communism the preeminent power on the continent. And I think, like a lot of people, all you had to do is look at the map, and if you think this little thing called the German army is going to overrun all of this and govern it, you've lost your mind. It's never going to happen. But that said, we have this problem. We go down this road repeatedly. But we've been able to do it because we have, or have had until now, almost limitless resources.
Yeah.
Let me give you a quick example of this kind of thinking. Kennedy and Nixon both served in the Second World War. Yeah. Both of them were in the Pacific. Both were in the Navy. Now, I don't know if any of you had, my father was at Okinawa aboard ship when they dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. He went through all that stuff, and he was one of these Higgins boat commanders, drivers. He was a sailor that brought in waves of Marines and soldiers and so forth. Anyway, if you saw what we had in the Pacific, it looked overwhelming, stupendous. Hundreds and hundreds of ships, thousands and thousands of aircraft. And so both Nixon and Kennedy had this perception of the American military machine as endless, absolutely unbeatable. You know, he blamed Vietnam and all sorts of things, but it wasn't the fault of the American military. We've blown it and so forth. Eisenhower had a very different picture. Eisenhower was in the West, and he ended up confronting this Battle of the Bulge. We don't need to go into the details there. But at the time, there were a lot of voices that said what happened, he should have been relieved. And Marshall was actually called to the White House, and Churchill asked him, said, look, this is the information we have. We think it's negligence on his part that this happened. It shouldn't have happened. Marshall hemmed and hawed, but didn't disagree. It was Churchill who calls FDR and says, please leave Ike where he is. Now, the reason for that was that he thought he could manipulate Eisenhower, which he had done somewhat with some measure of success up to that. But my point is that Eisenhower in January, he's so shaken by what's happened in the Bulge. He writes a letter to Marshall and says, I don't have enough divisions. I need another 10 divisions. I need this and this and this and this. And Marshall writes him back. He said, you've got all you're going to get. And by then, he had almost 70 divisions. He said, there are no more to send. We're fighting in the Pacific. We're running out of manpower. Eisenhower never forgot that. So he was acutely sensitive to all the limitations. So when he's president, what does he do? He ends the Korean War quickly. Let's get the deal and get the hell out of here. We're not poised. We're not postured to fight another war against another continental power like China. That's insane. We're not going to do it. If we're going to go to Lebanon, we're going to stay for Lebanon. We'll stay there for 12 months, and then we're leaving, regardless of what happens. We're not going to expend any more resources. So Eisenhower has a different view, and that shapes our behavior. That's why we invested in nuclear weapons, because he said, if we do this right, we'll never fight another major war. I mean, imagine a man saying that. He wasn't entirely wrong. And when we look at Great Britain, you ask yourself, well, what do we need to ensure that we are not a victim in another major war? That's a great question to ask. And that makes sense.
It's a really good question.
I mean, when the Argentinians invaded the Falklands in 1982, that was kind of we were spending 5% of our GDP on defense at that time. Of course, Steve was there in combat operations. You know, we simply, and it was a relatively, I mean, it's by UK standards, it was a sizable force, you know, that we deployed, but we wouldn't be able to do that now if the Argentinians were to make a move on it again, right?
Well, I think that it's worth looking at that particular operation for two reasons. You and we are primarily maritime and aerospace powers. That means our line of communication, our logistical operation is always of necessity very long. And that was a very difficult operation to conduct from a logistical standpoint. The second thing is a force of the size that you were able to assemble is a force size that you should consider for the future. Now, maybe organized a little differently, maybe equipped a little differently, but that's not a bad model. In fact, I talked about that when I was active duty as not a bad model for us. And what you had to do is decide, well, how large do you get or how small do you get so that you can deal with that kind of contingency? And you deal with it because you say it is in your national strategic interest, not because we think that we're going to rescue women who wear hijabs and bags from a life of slavery. Sorry, it's not a national strategic interest. So I think that's a good one to focus on. But then you have to guard against the situation that emerges after Campbell Bannerman leaves. Campbell Bannerman says, I'm not sending the British Expeditionary Force to the continent. Forget it. Well, then what are you going to do with it? Well, we may have to deal with the Russians. We can project this to the Baltic littoral, if we have to, against the Russians. We can send it to India, and it could fight in the Khyber Pass. But they also made an alliance with Japan, if you go back to 1905. And that alliance promised that if Britain had to fight Russia in India, the Japanese would provide 100,000 men. So they were thinking strategically about the things that mattered. That's what we've got to do now. India is no longer an issue, obviously. So do you necessarily need to be able to go to India? I don't know. But then you have to be ready to stand up and say what Campbell Bannerman said. Look, we didn't build this for a fight with the Russian army on its own terms, on its own turf in central Ukraine. That's a war we can't win. Yeah. That's a battle we don't want to fight. Dumb idea. Find something else, Mr. Minister. But nobody does it.
Yeah, that's a classic example, isn't it? I mean, I think the the thing about the strategic thinking is that you've really got to start from essentials. And, you know, the first essential is defense, not offense, it seems to me. So I did an article for the Times just after I'd left the service, 2011. I said that it was just, I was asked to write about a British defense review. And I said, well, when you're an island nation, that the key things you need is a decent defensive air force, a navy, the ability to protect your imports of commodities, energy and food, and the ability to have a role to play in your other locations, your overseas territories. So that is the essential need. And after that, everything's discretionary. So, you know, the problem is, though, that we've been seduced by the idea of NATO, and you know, NATO isn't as good as we think. And we've got that as one of our two pillars of European defense is NATO. And the other one, of course, is our relationship with the United States. But as I'm saying so often, you've got to look at the United States national security strategy. And at the moment, I would have Europe down as about number five. And if I were in the United States, that's what I'd do. You know, so it's about time that the Europeans stopped thinking that they've got to try and persuade the United States back into Europe when I don't think it's necessary. And also look askance at NATO. So look at your foundations of security and decide whether they're really best for the modern day, because they obviously aren't.
Well, when I was at SHAPE, we had these discussions. And one of the things I suggested at the time in a meeting was that in the future, the United States should focus of necessity on the independence of Great Britain, the islands, Norway, Iceland, Greenland, Canada. That's it.
Mm.
The North Atlantic.
Yeah.
That's important. And that's what we should focus on. It used to be the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Mm. It's now the Everywhere, Everything, All the Time Treaty Organization, which makes no sense and has no focus. And it's a waste of money. Who's going to take care of the continent? It's not us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at some point, the Germans, I'm sure, will reawaken. I'm confident of it. It's my view of, if you look at the world today as regions, who are the great powers that are going to rule the Middle East? It doesn't necessarily mean they march in, put armies on the ground, but they're the dominant powers who are going to shape what happens. Well, one is going to be Persia.
Mm.
The other is going to be Turkey, or Turkey, as they like to call it now. They are the dominant powers. If you look at this new alignment, Pakistan, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, it makes perfect sense. It's not really an alliance, but it's an alignment. Mm. It's really focused on ending this Greater Israel project. I would expect Egypt to join this. And I would see that as the Sunni cordon sanitaire.
Mm.
It stretches around this menacing state called Israel. That's what it is. Yeah. Now, you have another alliance, or let's say alignment, that's very similar. It's Russia, Persia, China.
Mm.
Now, that's unprecedented historically. The Turkish, Saudi, Sunni alliance all the way back, so that's not unprecedented. That makes a lot of sense. But for the Persians and the Chinese and the Russians to be this close is pretty unique. And Brzezinski warned this could happen.
Mm.
Sam Huntington, in his book, Clash of Civilizations, Brzezinski, very, very straightforward. He said, if this happens, that's we Americans are finished on the continent. We can't stand up to it. We can't control it. We can't compete with it. Well, you and I think Ian would all agree, we don't need to.
Mm.
What are we doing that for? I mean, if we want, what we want to do, we want to do business. We want commercial relations with all. We don't want to be locked into a set of hostilities in perpetuity with anybody. And how do we get to that?
Good question.
Yeah. I'm seeing Jonathan Haslam tomorrow, who wrote the fantastic book Hubris about the expansion of NATO and how it's caused the war in Ukraine. And there's a great quote in Gorbachev speaking to some senior American statesperson at the time, saying, "You know, you guys are going to be in real trouble now after the collapse of the Soviet Union, because you'll no longer have an enemy to sort of keep you in Europe." And just a really kind of fascinating insight. I think you're right. I mean, I think stability in Europe is only possible with an entente between the four main military powers, which is Britain, Germany, France, and Russia. And only when you're, because the Russians ultimately have no interest in putting all their eggs in the Chinese basket. They want to have a one foot in the European camp too. And I think we've missed that point at our peril. That's the only way we can reach some sort of stability. But that's only really possible when America refocuses out on its interests in the Western Hemisphere.
Ian, I agree with you, but I would ask you to include Poland.
Poland
thinks of itself as a great power. And right now, the Polish army is large enough, strong enough, disciplined enough, well-led enough, capable enough to march from Warsaw to Berlin to Paris without anybody being able to stop it. The Poles are great soldiers. Now, they're not great strategists. We know that. But what I'm trying to say is I would just include them in this. And, you know, you include France. I know that's a predisposition, but, you know, why? They have some nuclear weapons. I know that. But if you spend any time with the French, they have this river they call the Rhine. And as far as they're concerned, everybody east of it is a barbarian. And anything that happens there is irrelevant. Culture and civilization lie on the western side. And, oh, by the way, if you cross that channel, those people aren't too much better than the Europeans. So, you know, I think France is this sort of insular thing. You know, unless you end up with a revolution that produces a Bonaparte, I wouldn't worry about it. I think what's much more important at this point are Germany and Poland and Russia and the United States and Great Britain. But again, if we're part of this, what's our role? And what's your role? I mean, we, as I said, we should have a permanent security interest in the independence, freedom of action for Great Britain, Norway, Iceland, Greenland, Canada, the United States. That's it. We should have a permanent interest in Japan for the same reason, because of its proximity to Alaska and Russia. All right? You're looking at giant choke points, okay? Remember, we're maritime powers, so we need to think in those terms. I didn't find much success with that. Now, there's somebody that you ought to consider talking to. I served with him at SHAPE. I don't know what's happened to him. His name is Trevor Minter. He ended up, I think, as a major general. He was promoted to brigadier when he left, and he was from the Royal Regiment of Fusiliers. I think he led the charge to preserve various kinds of fusiliers without much success. So I guess what they have now are just one regiment of fusiliers or something. And, you know, that wasn't his fault, but he went up to Newcastle and fought the battle and lost. But he's a very smart man, and he was actually in a position as the, what would you call it? Is it aide de camp or is it executive officer to your equivalent of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs when Powell was chairman of the Joint Chiefs? And he has a lot of interesting things to say and a lot of good insight. And he's a little older than me, so I don't think he should be too concerned about whatever he says now. But you never know. He's a very careful man. But Minter, M-I-N-T-E-R.
M-I-N-T-E-R.
Very smart man.
I'll look him up. He's like the Larry Wilkerson equivalent then, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, he was, like I said, I think Trevor ultimately retired as a two-star, major general.
Okay.
And he was promoted to brigadier after he left. And I just thought he was a very good, solid, competent man. But he has kind of a unique insight into that level. And he saw us as well as his own at the time. And it may be, some of his views may be valuable because he also saw the same things I did from inside of NATO.
Yeah.
And, you know, we came to the same conclusion, we, the British, the Germans, that there was another line. And this was what we called the Roman line. And the people you could rely on who would show up to fight under any and all circumstances were west and north of the Roman line. They were Germans, Danes, Dutch, Norwegians, British. In other words, they could be brought together pretty flawlessly, pretty quickly, and they would work well together, get things done. Then the other group that was kind of entertaining were the Austrians. They weren't in it. But the Austrian National Military Representative, I got into an argument when I was down in Vienna for an OSCE meeting, and I was kidding them, but I said, you know, I'm so tired of you Austrians. They said, what do you mean? Because I speak German, you know, and I said, you're running around saying, we're not Germans, we're Austrians. I said, I walk all over this damn city and everything of any historic significance says German on it. I said, you speak German. You're Germans. No, we're Austrians. I said, we're So what happened was we had this meeting, and this was under, I guess this was under General McKenzie, Jeremy McKenzie, a very wonderful man. Mm-hmm. And he was very good politically at bringing all of these different people together. And it was about forces to go into where it would eventually go into Kosovo then. But this is a long time before that. Anyway, the Austrian came in and they said, well, with which of these national brigade groups of, like 5,000, do you want to be a part? And interestingly enough, for instance, the Turks went in with the British, or excuse me, with the Germans. And the Norwegians wanted to be with the British. I mean, you could always predict these things. The Dutch would go with the British. And it came around to the Austrians. If you're going to contribute to this, well, we'll go with the German brigade. They sent this letter in. We will join you. So I copied this and I sent it off to Vienna and I said, no more discussion, no more debate, stop hiding out. But, NATO, when I got to NATO, I asked, in fact, it may have been Trevor Minter, as I recollect. I said, well, in the absence of the Soviets, what's NATO do? You know, I'll be frank with you. I was one of these people in 95 that felt it should just go away.
Yeah.
And it just wasn't needed anymore. And he said, well, in the absence of the Soviet threat, we only have one natural enemy, the French.
Yes. Yeah. An enduring British obsession as well, I sense.
I had the French military, and it brought me to his home for dinner.
Yeah.
And I was trying my broken French, which wasn't very good. But a nice group of people. And he said, well, Douglas, you know what the problem is in NATO. I said, what's that? He said, it's perfidious Albion. Then I received a letter by the British were a problem, So a lot of these things never change.
Yeah. What's that expression? The British and the French are both arrogant, but both think that the other's wrong. Something like that. I can't remember.
The French say we're a country of 100 religions and one source, and that they're a country of one religion and 100 sources. But there we go. It's all about, as Chaz Freeman would say, finding some sort of entente. Chaz Freeman would say it's all about finding an entente, not an alliance, an entente. And that's all about kind of forming sort of not an alignment, but an understanding with the Russians, the Germans, the Poles, the Brits. And once you do that, it's far easier to figure out your core strategic interests. And that's basically not killing each other pointlessly and allowing your respective economy to thrive as a result of that. But the sooner we get back to that, the better.
Yeah, I think it's pick you up on Doug's point. It's about getting back to trade as well. I mean, I listened to a really, really good American former soldier who does short podcasts about China. I'm astonished how well the Chinese are doing. It's not a question of actually stopping the Chinese accelerate ahead of us. They are ahead of us. They're ahead of us a long way. They build about 80% of the world's ships. They've been training people. He was talking about the reasons why they might be taking less oil, which is they're actually converting coal into fuels. So for a whole load of reasons, and when you look at it, time and again, the Chinese have come so far. And I think it's about time we stop pretending that actually we can compete and rather started thinking to ourselves, well, perhaps we should be trying to learn from the Chinese and trying to learn from the Russians, because they are doing a lot of things much better than us. And a bit of humility wouldn't go too far, I'm afraid, not least.
You mentioned the H word, humility. That's
humility.
Yes.
Yeah.
The problem we have here, Jeremy and Ian, is that people that are sitting in the Pentagon or over in, the Hill, they're reading all of this sort of terrible crap by this man, Gordon Chang. And they believe that China is a sort of imperial Japan in waiting. And then you have Mearsheimer, who says, based on his wealth of knowledge and study of great power politics, it is inevitable then we will challenge the rising power, China, and there will be a war. Okay. I don't agree with any of that, because I think anyone who studied Chinese civilization, Chinese aren't interested in that. Hmm. They're doing what they would do naturally. What the old communists finally figured out in Deng Xiaoping was to experiment and let it run wild. Mm-hmm. It ran wild. It was very effective. What the difference is, though, between China and, say, the United States or other countries, is that when you go too far and you're prepared to invite in foreigners to participate in what you're doing or to help fund you or something else, Chinese don't want it. Mm-hmm. They're not going to surrender their control of their industries, their economy to anyone. And that's why you don't hear anything more about this man, Ma, what was it that he built?
Alibaba.
Yeah, exactly, Alibaba. Mm. He went too far, and he was an object lesson for everybody else. Mm. So you've got to be patriotic and loyal first and foremost to China. I would argue the Japanese take a similar view, but the difference is that whereas China is very decentralized, we have this picture in the United States of this highly centralized authoritarian state. That's not true.
Mm.
Is it that way? But Chinese are different from us.
Yeah.
I mean, sorry, they are.
Yeah.
Everybody everywhere is not the same. And the Chinese and the people on Taiwan, I would argue. And I would argue to a large extent, there are some others in Asia, but the Chinese on Taiwan as well as the mainland, they really all want to live in the same kind of environment. Mm. It's called Singapore.
Mm.
Yes, indeed. Singapore, where my mother was born.
Is that right?
Yeah, my dad was in the army there back in the day, shortly after independence, as we're just starting to draw down our troop presence there during the confrontation with Sukarno in Indonesia. But yeah, these are the days. No more expeditionary kind of endeavors for us. I think we've taken up enough of your time, Dougo. Kawasaki, you only had 45 minutes. I've already impinged too much on your good graces. But I think my key takeaway from this is that actually, well, as we've said for a long time, wars are won by economies, not armies. The days of expeditionary warfare are kind of largely over. I think in our respective strategies, we recognize the need to kind of focus on our own particular areas of interest, in our case, Atlantic Bastion, in your case, the Western Hemisphere, and get along with everybody if we can. But it feels like we're a long way from reaching that point of recognition amongst our political class. But for now,
well, we've got to get rid of the ideologues.
Yeah.
Got to get rid of the ideologues.
It takes 10 years to build an army. Sorry. Yeah. And it takes at least 20 to build a navy.
Yeah.
And then people need to understand these. They don't get it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we've got to get rid of the ideologues. Yeah.
Well, when you're in the south, there's only one way to go.
A pleasure yet again. Nice to chat again.
See you again.
Thank you kindly, gents.